agenda tonight. I believe what most of you are here for this evening is our first item, which is our municipal agitation. And I want to start right on time in part because there are other counselors here in addition to those on the committee who need to leave at 7:45 for another meeting. Or they may be coming here, but it will be disruptive. So, this is a regularly scheduled meeting of the Public Facilities Committee. Today is Wednesday, March 8th. We are being audio recorded, as usual, just so you all know. And the item that we have before us, which I will read into the record in a minute, is the first step in what I understand to be a very long process, and we're going to learn what the process is this evening, that the city has to go through to inquire about, understand, hold public meetings, determine the particulars of the program that we want for our city, if we want this program, and that this process, if we get hit the ground running, which could take as long as or as soon as we might get done with it, which is January, so of 2018. So tonight, we're hoping to take the first step. I am hoping to vote on the item before us tonight, which is to authorize the city administration to begin that long process. I'm going to begin, before I do the item into the record, it's typical, I will introduce myself. I'm Deb Crossway, I'm chair of the Public Facilities Committee, and I am counselor from Hudson Ward 5, joined by, to my left, is Susan Albright, vice chair of the committee, and counselor at large from Ward 2, then Martha Laredo, counselor at large from Ward 7, Barbara Bussal-Glazer, ward counselor from Ward 3, President Scott Lennon, who is also a counselor at large from Ward 1, and then the other side of the table, Lenny Gentile, counselor at large from Ward 4, Vicki Danberg, at large from Ward 6, and our committee clerk, Nadia Khan. We are also joined by counselors from other committees, in other words, they won't vote with us tonight, and that is Ruthanne Fuller in the orange sweater over here, who is counselor at large, also from Ward 7, and Allison Leary, counselor, ward counselor from Ward 1. I believe that's it for the council so far. So the item before us is 42-17, which is a request to authorize a contract to aggregate the electricity load. Councilors Crossley, Albright, Bussal-Glazer, Leary, and Norton requesting the City Council authorize the administration to direct the appropriate city departments to research, develop, and participate in a contract or contracts to aggregate the electricity load of residents and businesses in the City of Newton and for other related services independently or in joint action with other municipalities, and authorize the mayor to execute all documents to accomplish the same. So,
May I just ask, I see some people standing. There are some chairs in the corner that maybe we could
set them up. Thank you. You're fine, but maybe we should bring another chair out this way anyhow.
Thank you, Andy.
All right. So first of all, I want to introduce Newton. Is very fortunate to have a sustainability director position, and not only do we have one sustainability director, but we have two outstanding people to share the job, and Andy Savage is standing up to delivering the chair. Not part of the job description, and Anne Berwick over in the corner, who's going to join us because Anne is going to be foremost on this item, I believe. That's one of the divisions of labor, and Anne is going to talk about this from a state perspective. As Anne comes from working with the Patrick administration for many years, both in DOER and the Department of Public Utilities.
Actually,
the OEA,
yeah,
and the Department of Public Utilities.
Department
of Public Utilities.
Yeah.
So, and
I will
let,
we have someone coming in and I can be here tonight, but I'll let you introduce him as well.
Okay, great. So, thanks, Deb, and I'm really happy to be here, and I'm very happy to be working locally. So, I'm going to keep this brief, in fact, I'm sure to keep it brief. Patrick Roach from MAPC is going to really give you a lot of the details about aggregation, and I'm just going to go over some of the basics and a few stats. So, full disclosure, at the DP, the Department of Public Utilities, where I served for 5 years in the Patrick administration, I was in charge of approving municipalities' aggregation plans. So I've seen it from quite a different perspective. So I'm actually learning a lot seeing it from the local perspective. So I just I'm going to say some things that probably almost all of you are familiar with, but I think it's important background when we're talking about aggregation. And that is the most basic is that Eversource delivers but does not generate our electricity. It buys our electricity. All Newton ratepayers who have not chosen their own suppliers of electricity, the people who generate, the companies who generate electricity, get their electricity from Eversource on what's called basic service. So Eversource buys the electricity and delivers it to to us. And that's just a pass-through. They don't make any money on that. That's basic service. And most residential households and small businesses in the state are on basic service. A lot of big businesses and the city itself have opted out and have their own suppliers. But most of the people in this room, but most of the residential ratepayers are on basic service. So one more bit of background. That's relevant to what you're reading here tonight. And again, I apologize because I think probably most of you know this story. But so background, a piece of the green energy story at the state level is that there's something called Renewable Portfolio Standards, RPS. And under the Renewable Portfolio Standards, utilities are required, so Eversource in our case, is required to buy of the power it buys on basic service, the electricity it buys, it's required to buy this year 12% from certain kinds of renewable sources. And that goes up 1% a year, although there are a bunch of bills before the legislature arguing this to go up more quickly. So Eversource buys 12% of its electricity from renewables, a particular kind of renewables called Class 1 renewables. And these Class 1 renewables produce what are called renewable energy credits, or RECs. And I'm not going to burn you, I don't think, with any more of this kind of jargon, but it's important to understand that. So when we talk, as we are going to talk shortly, I'm going to talk, and I'm sure Patrick is going to talk, about 5% Class 1. What it means is that as part of an ag, or it could be any other percentage, it could be 2%, it could be 3%, it could be 10%, but I'll just say 5%. 5% Class 1 means Newton, on behalf of its ratepayers, as part of its aggregation, would purchase 5% more RECs on top of the 12%. In other words, 17% renewable energy. So if Newton had an aggregation plan that had, and I'm just saying hypothetically, 5% renewables, that would mean on top of the 12% that Eversource already has to deliver us as part of basic service, we would be getting 17% of our electricity from renewable sources and from a certain kind of renewable sources, right? Class 1, that's sort of the gold standard, you know, new solar, wind, geothermal. Actually, maybe not geothermal. Right?
anaerobic digestion.
Anaerobic digestion. Yeah. But I think not. Not you. I'm Alexa. But anyway. Okay. So, there we are. Does anybody have any questions about that? Because that's really the basis of what we're talking about here with aggregation. Okay. No. So, let me talk briefly about aggregation. With an aggregation plan, all ratepayers who are currently on basic service, since most residential ratepayers and small commercial ratepayers, are on aggregation unless they opt out. So that is the default. The default is if there's an aggregation plan on the city, you're on the aggregation plan unless you choose to opt out of it. If anybody, however, can opt out at any time without a fee. So there's no charge to opting out, but unless you opt out, you're in. And if you're on the aggregation, Eversource still delivers your power. You're paying one electricity bill, and Eversource is delivering your power. And if there's a storm, and power goes out, Eversource is, and nothing changes, really nothing changes in your experience of getting your electricity. Okay. Aggregation doesn't guarantee savings. I'll explain how common in a minute. But it makes savings extremely likely because the consultant broker has more flexibility than Eversource does about when and how it goes out to purchase. So state law tells Eversource you have to go out to buy electricity on such and such a date and for such and such an amount of time. But the consultant or broker for an aggregation has way more flexibility and can make judgments about the market instead of being directed by statute. But the reason you can never be sure, absolutely positive, that it's going to save money is because whether or not you're going to save money is a question of whether you're going to do better than basic service, right? And you can't know for sure what the basic service rates are going to be. So, but the odds of saving money are extremely high. Okay, so here's the data I'm aware of about the experience with aggregation. It's mainly from Good Energy, which is one of the three, I think, consultants or brokers. I'm just going to call them consultants instead of saying consultants or brokers. I've been dealing with, on account of the fact they have a relationship with MAPC, and Patrick is here from MAPC, and he'll tell you more about that relationship. So most of the data I have comes from Good Energy. So there are about 80, this is just general data, not necessarily Good Energy, there are about 80 aggregations already approved in Massachusetts. So this is not a fantastically new idea. And about 40 more are in process. So, and there are only 351 or whatever, 352, I don't know, cities and towns in the Commonwealth, right? So that's a hefty chunk of the municipalities in the Commonwealth. So about 120 either approved or in process. However, using aggregation for purchasing renewables is a relatively new idea. So most of these 120 are, certainly most of the 80, are not, quote, green aggregations. In fact, when I was at the DPU, I always wondered how come we weren't seeing green aggregations. What we were seeing was using aggregations in order to do bulk, sensible purchasing, sensible in that it's not dictated by statute exactly when you have to go for it, to save money. But then cities and towns started to realize, hey, we could save money and get greener. And that's what we're seeing now. So Dedham and Melrose, we have a year of data on. And they did 5% class 1. And you know now what I mean when I say that. And they saved money as compared to basic service. So even with the 5% class 1 debt purchase, they saved money. And what Good Energy has told me, and so I'm just telling you, I don't have firsthand information on this, I'm quoting Good Energy, is that they estimate that they saved about $15 a year per household with the extra 5%. And the 5% was the default, by the way. That was
if you, that wasn't an opt-in, it was an opt-out. So if you didn't opt-out, you were on the 5%. Good Energy, which again is the consultant to MAPC, has 38 aggregations in Massachusetts, 24 approved, and 23 are in one buying group. And I don't know whether you're going to hear more about that sometimes or not, but they have 12 months of data from the 23. Remember I told you Melrose and Adetta would save the money with 5% class 1. So, these are not all 5% class 1. So some of them are green and some of them aren't. And what Good Energy tells me is that in the month, the 12 months of data, some lost a little and some won a little, but they believe that everyone will, it's a two-year contract, that everyone will do better than basic service over 24 months. So that's their projection, right? We don't have absolute, we don't know for sure. And what they have told me is that New Bedford, so that's a pretty big city, is one of the 23. And they had a green opt-in, not an opt-out, and they project that each household should save about between $30 and $60 over 2 years. So that's just that's a vanilla, what I'll call a vanilla aggregation, not a green aggregation. So other consultants, the two other consultants aren't all good news, but, and again, I don't have first-hand information on this. But Salem, Swampscott, and Natick, Salem and Swampscott did a 5% green, but mostly not class 1. So not as, so I think tax school probably talks about the difference between class 1 and not class 1, or?
We'll
be I don't know if we want to get into that weedy, but they stopped the green, but they are actually still aggregated. And as I understand it, Natick did not have a successful experience. So there are some towns out there that didn't have a successful experience, but Good Energy, my understanding is Good Energy says they have had nothing but success. But I'm not here to, you know, particularly advocate for them. They're just my source of information, mostly Patrick and Good Energy, because Good Energy works with MAPC are my main sources of information. So all of the following are now before the DPU with a 5% class 1 proposal, except for Brookline, with what I've heard is a 25% class 1 proposal. And all of these are with Good Energy. And those are Arlington. So these are all pending before the DPU, 5%, except Brookline, which is much higher. Arlington, Brookline, Gloucester, Hamilton, Somerville, Sudbury, and Winchester. And then others that are either pending or are active and aren't with Good Energy, and I don't know their green status, active are Lowell, Greenfield, and Auburn. So I'm just telling you some recent ones that have been approved and some recent ones that have come into the process, like the ones I just read off to you, are Acton, Cambridge, and Lexington. So I'm going to stop in 1 minute. There's a lot of aggregation out there. A lot of communities are considering it. A lot of communities are now using it both to try to save money and to buy greener power. As I said, it's not risk-free in terms of saving, but the odds of saving money are quite high. I think it has two advantages in terms of green power. It increases cities' own demand for renewables, right? But also, there are a number of bills before the legislature to increase the rate of increase in the renewable portfolio standards. And I think it sends a signal to the legislature that there's public support for the bills that are pending to increase the RPF. So it does both things. And, you know, at this point, there are so many aggregations that it's not, cities and towns that adopt an aggregation really aren't reinventing the wheel. But there are some options that cities and towns will need to consider, such as whether to go green or not, if going green, how much green, and also the length of the contract. And most contracts are, maybe all contracts are either 1, 2, or 3 years. So those are the the main decisions that need to be made out there. Other than that, you know, it's kind of, it's not a mystery anymore how to do it.
So before we introduce Patrick, a couple things. First of all, I want to recognize Carol Lappin, who joined us, who's a member of the committee and board member from Ward 8. We have a couple questions for clarification just what you said.
Okay.
But and even before that, I just want to remind, because a number of people came into the room, that although we're going to get a lot of information tonight so we get an idea of what this is about, all we are charged to do tonight, if we choose to do so, is to recommend to the full council to authorize the city to move ahead and begin to disseminate this information and understand it and present us with the options. So Mark had a question and Susan.
So I want to understand a little bit better what you're explaining. So as I understand it, the most basic issue is, do we have some kind of municipal aggregation or not?
Yeah.
Lots of cities and towns have done it. Data looks really good that you save money on that. Not guaranteed, but pretty high probability. Okay. So that piece, of course, where it seems to me relatively straightforward and easy. I want to understand the green piece more.
Yeah.
I mean green piece. Better choice of words. So some cities, and I understand there's a bunch of applications out there, some as high as 25%, but there's a couple of cities and towns that tried that and it didn't work for them. And I want to understand why it didn't work, as best you can understand, and if we go this route, what we would do differently so we don't have the problems that they had.
Yeah. So my understanding is that Patrick will be better on this than I am, because he's worked with Good Energy now for some time. They have a contract with Good Energy. Is that all of Good Energy, so I think the art in this is on the part of the consultant slash broker in knowing when to go out to purchase. So pull the trigger now. This is the time when we ought to lock in a price. And my understanding is that all of Good Energy's aggregations have been successful or are projected to be successful. And by successful, I mean have saved money for the cities and towns that they have done aggregation plans for. I do not believe they are all green, but the green ones have saved, my understanding is that the green ones have saved money and that the vanilla ones have saved money. And for the ones that have not been successful, like Natick, I can't speak to their business, but they're not, well, I don't even want to guess at why they haven't.
And I'm going to suggest that this is the kind of thing that we would certainly be digging into along the way, right? So you can get a better understanding of who's doing what and what they're.
But I think I would just add one thing in answer to that question, which is, in theory, aggregation should be successful. Now, of course, you know, there's a difference between 5% and 75% green, and I don't know how that plays out in terms of actual numbers. But because the broker can go, is not dictated by statute when exactly and for how long they have to enter into a contract, a sophisticated energy buyer who knows when to pull the trigger should be able to get a better deal than the utilities, which don't have the flexibility that the broker has because of the statutory obligation.
I really want to move into the presentation
because we're watching the clock here. Is it a question for clarification?
So, yeah, I think you said that regardless of which way you do it, if you aggregate or not, your service is still comes through Eversource.
Correct.
Is that what you said?
That is true.
Okay, so I won't even try to understand how they know what they're delivering to me and whether it's through aggregation or through their own thing, but I'm sure there's a way for them to know that.
They have computers. I don't
know. Any questions, clarification?
Yes. Sorry, yes. So when you said that a city or town might choose aggregation, and then you said something about opting out or opting in. Are we talking about the electricity just that the city or town uses, or are we talking about everybody in the town?
In fact, we're not talking about the electricity that the city or town uses, because the city or town isn't on basic service. And most big users, big industrial users, commercial users, don't subscribe to basic service. They've got their own supplier. So we're talking about everybody who's on basic service, which is most residences and most small businesses.
And they would have the option of opting out if they didn't want to be a part of it.
Yes, at any time, without a fee.
Okay.
Okay. Would you like to introduce Patrick from MAPC?
Yeah. So, Patrick. this is Patrick Rose from MAPC. I heard his presentation to just a group of interested citizens a week or two ago. And I was extremely impressed. He was a really remarkable teacher. So, I'm gonna turn it over. We can switch it.
Before we get started, we've been joined by Emily Norton, also ward counselor from Ward 2. Okay.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much, Anne. That was excellent. And what's good is didn't leave me with too much to cover. And I know that worked well with our time. So you did a great job explaining what this concept is. So I've got a few slides, and I'll try to leave a lot of time for questions you can discuss and pick up some content there. So for just quickly for folks who don't know us, we're the regional planning agency for the greater Boston region, and we work with our cities and towns on a lot of different issues. Some of them listed there. I'm at our clean energy group, and so we help cities and towns work on strategies that can reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And so what got us interested in aggregation was this potential to help cities and towns achieve some economic benefits around their electricity, especially for people on fixed incomes or low income. It can be really powerful to get some of these economic savings, and also to combine it with a way to leverage the buying power of the city or town to move forward your green goals. So that was where we came from it, and we were very involved in the NOAAs and the GEDM programs that Ann spoke about in getting those moving. We also did a competitive price and qualification space process on behalf of our entire region for a consultant to work with our cities and towns, and so that's why we have a relationship with Good Energy through that process. This will be posted, so I'm going to skip through a lot of this because they covered it really well in terms of what is aggregation. The electricity bill 101, delivery versus supply. I have a bill here to show that. So I'm going to skip through a bunch of this about basic service, which we kind of already covered. And here we are, municipal aggregation. I think Anne covered all of this really well, in the fact that it's automatic enrollment. There'll be a default rate. You can offer optional rates if you'd like. One thing that I think is interesting, a number of cities and towns that we're working with, they have a default, that's 5%. They have an option to go up, say 100% renewables, but they also have an option to go down, and go down to just the minimum that the state requires. What we've seen from the data in Melrose and Dedham is very few people end up taking that, but it's politically very powerful because people don't have to leave the aggregation to get the benefits of the better price and the price stability. So that's a good idea to offer that opt-down option. Really covered these benefits really well. One of the other things I'll just mention is that through this process, and certainly Melrose would speak to this, there's a lot of consumer education that happens, and a lot of people find out for the first time that they have a choice in this matter, and some of them do choose to opt out and go to the competitive markets themselves because they're not required to. But Melrose found that especially a lot of folks with senior citizens and folks on fixed incomes, that they really appreciated the education about what was happening with their bill and how the city was trying to help them out with an offer option to help with it. So, skip over the renewable energy piece. I'm not going to go too into the weeds on that right now, but I think in general, you have a lot of buying power with your aggregation. And you can structure it in a way where you increase the amount of renewable energy you have a bit for everyone, but it's not so much that you lose the economic benefit, so that you can kind of have your cake and eat it too in that sense. And that's what's really powerful about aggregation, is you have the size to achieve really good buying power and impact from a renewable energy standpoint. I'm happy to go into that more in questions. And so as Anne mentioned, these are all the towns who are about to implement. Gloucester was just approved by the DCU, I think, a week or so ago, which is great. So they're the first to sort of race ahead. What I want to cover mostly is the implementation process, so you get a sense of how you'd actually roll this out. So you usually work with a consultant, as Anne mentioned, and they essentially, this consultant handles everything from developing the aggregation plan with you, to getting it through the state regulatory review process, to doing the public outreach and education prior to the launch of the program, monitoring the market during the program. So they're really doing all of this for you. And the consultants typically work at risk until the program is operational. And then what happens is everyone pays their single Eversource bill, like they've always been doing. The supply line, instead of saying basic service, will say whatever supplier you've chosen. On the back end, that supplier pays a small fee to the consultant. So that's how that works. So the process, we have two slides of process. The city council authorizes the city to investigate aggregation and develop a plan. So that's what Deb was talking about. It's an authorization to go forth and investigate this and maybe develop a plan. Usually the next step is to select a consultant to help you with this process, and then they'll work with you to develop the aggregation plan. These plans at this point are fairly standard in terms of what they have to do to make sure you treat all the ratepayers equitably and fairly and follow the rules. But some of the big decisions you'd be making at that point would be, what do you want to do with renewable energy? That's probably one of the biggest variables. You have to give an opportunity for public review and comment, and get that plan out there for the public to review and comment on. Most, but it's not required, most cities and towns have either the city council or the board of selectmen approve the plan before they send it off to get state review. So robust public engagement process, and then the plan goes to the Department of Energy Resources first. They consult with you, kind of give like a stamp of approval. But the real approval comes from the Department of Public Utilities. And that process can take 3 months, it can take 9 months. It really depends. But this is where it gets a rigorous vetting at the state level from a lot of different parties. The Attorney General's office usually takes a look at it, the utilities are taking a look at it. So the nice thing is that it can take a while, but when it comes out, this is a plan that's been looked at a lot of different ways for its quality. And then once you're approved, then the consultant's looking at the market with you and figuring out when is actually time to go up the bid. And when they do, there'll be a bid day, like a supplier if you want. You're never under obligation to actually execute. So you can go out to bid, prices can come back, and you can say, we don't want to execute. And they're still working at risk. Once you do select a supplier, there'll be a minimum of a 30-day public education period, but most communities start that even a little bit earlier, and you know, that's the bare minimum. And people can opt out before the program even starts. And there's a minimum of mailing, but also website and email ways to opt out, and so on ways. So people can opt out before you even start, but then again, once the program launches, they can opt out at any time. In the next bill cycle, they'll be back to basic service. And just to stress, it is automatic enrollment for anyone who's still on basic service. And you know, if you have, say, a solar on your roof, the net metering credits someone gets from that are on the delivery portion of the bill. This is only affecting the supply portion, so those benefits aren't impacted. If they're getting all their supply from their solar panels, this would only affect that little portion they might use from the grid from time to time. So that was really it, and this is just some of the stuff that we had already covered, just to have up in the background for Q&A. But Yeah, so I think Dan did a great job. I just wanted to cover the process, and I'm happy to talk about questions.
Okay, everybody has a question, but I just want to point one thing out before we go to questions. In our packet, there's a few pages that you delivered to us, and one of the steps in here is missing from what you have on your slide. I noticed there's two opportunities for public engagement, but there was a return to City Council for final decision on whether to implement.
Yep. The statute does not require that City Council authorization to submit it to the state. I believe Cambridge is one recently who did not do that, but most other aggregations.
So they require us to authorize the administration, but not to again look at the plan as it develops.
I think from what the statute, the bare minimum requires, that's not part of it.
Okay, I just wanted us to keep that in mind for decision today. All right, I didn't see whose hand up went up.
Oh,
start with Scott and go around the table and around the room. Scott.
Thanks. Just real quickly, on the selection of the consultants, is that a big
Yes, we did
a VBA, would we be interested for our own consultants to do that?
You would be welcome to do whatever you'd like, but what our goal was is that we selected it on behalf of the entire region, so if any municipality wants to work with them, you can sign this little subscription form that we have, and then it would be as if you did that full 30D process yourself. So the idea was we wanted to make it a little easier and faster for communities if they were interested in it.
So by authorizing this, we're starting a process by using your
No. You are just starting the process of aggregation. The second step would be to choose your consultant. And that
we have the option.
Two questions. You said about some people opting down, so you have to decide on 5% as a city, and then they might want to say, I only want 1%. Would someone's reason to do that be because they'll have more savings? If it's less green, that's why they would...
Yep. So there would be a little bit of cost for that 5% ticket baked into the electricity rate. They would have a little bit of extra savings.
I agree. They might not be able to say, if let's say the default was 5%, then it might not be the case that you can say 1%, I can say 2%, you can say 3%. It's probably being
better than that. Yeah. Two options in the program.
Yeah.
You
can go 2% or, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but we wouldn't give an infinite number of
costs. Okay, thank you. And then, let's say we do a 3-year contract. Our consultant goes out and buys us energy for 3 years. And we've decided as a city to do that 5%. Mm-hmm. Can we say after a year, this isn't working, let's change it. Or, this is great, let's bump it up. Or once we've decided, are we locked into the percentage we've chosen?
So I think that two questions. Generally, I would say you are locked in. I would not be surprised if you want to buy more. Probably fine to do that. If you wanted to buy less, that would be hard. But people can individually opt out at any time. So people are individually never stuck. But from the renewable portion, I think it would be pretty easy to go up. Probably not down. Okay.
So, to follow up on the questions I asked Dan a little earlier, I understand the aggregation concept pretty well. It makes a lot of sense. The green piece, again, terrible choice of words.
No, it's a good one.
Well, whatever. Thanks. What's the extra cost to go green typically? And are we then saying to our residents, unless you opt out, you are going to go green, but it's going to cost you more money, but we think that's a good public policy decision. How's that going to work?
So my answer would be, if you look at Melrose, the 5% default rate was 9.6 cents, and the rate where they had no extra 5% that opt down, that was 9.4, so 0.2 cents.
So what's that over the course of the year for a year?
I think over the course of the year that was about, it was about $1.50 a month to 20 bucks a year. I think is what Martha told me today.
So I just want to be clear. We're saying to our residents, we think this is a very important societal goal. We're going to contract for you. It's going to cost you $20 a year more than it would cost you if we decided not to have that goal.
Just to be clear, at least from Melrose, it saves, even with a 5% green, it saves people money relative to what they
I absolutely understand that, but there's a cost there. Now, is it permissible to do it the other way around, where you have people opt in to this rather than opt out, or does it have to be an opt out system?
So the program itself has to be opt out. It has to be an automatic enrollment.
Okay.
That's by statute. Yeah. And I would say that what we saw in Melrose, they did have these optional rates, and this isn't typical of other optional rates. You get less than 1% uptake of those rates.
And for the green part of it, those of us who say, great, we want renewable energy, we're willing to pay that little bit more,
mm-hmm.
fine, we'll give you an easy opt-out for those who say, I don't care about renewables, I want to save my $20.
Yep, so it would be super easy. So on the mailing, on the website, it would have, if you do nothing, you'll stay in this. But if you'd like to opt out of the program entirely, check here. If you want to move to a different rate, check here.
And we would have, I'm sorry, we'd have the ability to structure that as part of our program.
Right.
So we could be very aggressive, for example, and give residents an opportunity to save, to go to 25%. And within that, give residents the ability to opt out of the green portion.
Yep. And then when you develop the plan, that's the time where those decisions come.
Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Susan. So I think you started to answer my question, because you said that it takes from 3 months to 9 months to get a plan approved. So I was wondering, what are the key variables that could cause things to take longer to get approved? What are the main issues here?
It used to be that the Attorney General's office did not look very favorably on aggregation. The new Attorney General does not have that problem. So the old Attorney General raised the same questions in every aggregation up before the DCU, even though they have been settled effectively. That slowed down a lot. Right now, the DCU is very understaffed for their hearing officers, and that's what is taking really delaying a lot of these aggregations. So it's from a content standpoint, they're seeing the same type of plan that, you know, there's been a lot of these now, so they're drafting very similarly, it's really some of these external factors.
Okay, because I would have thought it would be sort of boilerplate by now.
Yep.
So it is.
This happened, since we went with the NACC contract, that would be faster, but I'm assuming, I don't actually, not having been a city employee for very long, I don't know how long the procurement process, we go out with our own RFPs, would take. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, the procurements, I think people often leave them out for, you know, 4 weeks, and there's the, you know, to develop it, and then the time to evaluate and introduce. So it does,
it depends on the type of data. So if you feel there, how much you're trying to deal with it, that plays into it sometimes.
Do they care about the kind of plan that we pick?
They don't have,
No, that's up to us.
Right. Electric wanting to do something they haven't seen before, that might take a little extra time.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to go around this way. So, you have a question?
Barbara asked one of my questions, and I missed the very beginning. I apologize. I had another meeting. So, what is the rate? Do we get the rate initially? And then what if half the people opted out? Would we still have that rate, or would the rate fluctuate?
So the rate's fixed. Based on the sort of history of aggregations, the suppliers have a sense of what the opt-out rates tend to be. I think Massachusetts so far, we've seen about 5%, 5 to 7% of people tend to opt out right from the very beginning. So they have a sense, and they sort of price that in, but it's a fixed price, even if half of them both opted out.
And it's a 1-2-3 year contract. Do we get to choose?
Yeah, so there's some prep work to do ahead of time to show you indicative pricing, the differences between 1, 2, and 3. They're going to talk to you about what they think the market's going to be doing, so you can have a sense of, does it make sense to do 2 years, or should we just do 1 year?
And we lock in the price at 3.
Or even during 3. Only, I think, one community's gone to 3, but the lawsuit 1 and the lawsuit 2, depending on what's happening in the market.
All right, because I know we did that bidding process, that blind bidding process for, is that for electricity? For
yeah, that was for the city electricity.
That was city electricity,
right.
And that did not go very well.
This is a different,
include the city.
Yeah.
Most of my questions have been answered. About between 5 and 7% of the residents in cities tend to opt out. And Melrose, you said Melrose, it was less than 1%, so they had a low opt out rate. Melrose, or was that 1% something different?
Yes, I think it was. So for the people who stayed in the program, less than 1% chose one of the optional.
I see. Okay, and to whom would we look as a city for guidance as to things like when we would go out to bid and that sort of thing? Who helps us with that?
So great. So that is one of the consultants' primary roles, and they're going to be working with certain staff at the city. City's already, working with a broker to purchase its city electricity. So there's already sort of staff who are knowledgeable about this, and I imagine that the broker or consultant will be working very closely with them. And what their goal is to be educating those decision makers on what the market's doing, what pricing is doing, what the outlook is, sort of building them up to know when they see prices back, a good price, to continue or not. So it's really between those decision makers and consultants, really, that's the sort of knowledge expert.
Okay.
We have our own consultants to help us evaluate what's going on with the aggregation. It might well be the consultants could help us with our municipal energy person.
I see. Okay. And one last question. You mentioned that in the past, the Attorney General tended to ask the same questions over and over. What were some of those questions, for example? That they would ask. What issues did they have issues with?
A lot of it, I think, was.
There's
three main ones operating in the market with clients in
that. There's only three in all of Massachusetts?
Until about 2 years ago, there were only two. And Good Energy came into Massachusetts after working in Illinois and some mid-Atlantic ones because the market was looking like a good time to do this. So there's three. There was a merger also. A fourth one came in, but they merged with one of these different ones.
So it sounds like the answer to Mark's question earlier about what was wrong in Natick may simply be that they chose the wrong consultant.
That's what we've heard.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm good.
All right. Thank you. Are there other questions? Emily?
I believe Massachusetts is one of only 6 states that allows you, so that might be why there aren't that many consultants.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we should start a little business then.
I can't imagine it shows you a business.
I can.
All right, we're not going to go past 8 o'clock, folks. We're covering 5 weeks to a vote.
No. Now, I just want to clarify, I thought you had said that some cities or towns had it as opt-in, but I thought Patrick said that you could only do opt-out. I just want to clarify.
Yeah, I think we're talking about for the aggregation, this opts out. But for particular levels of green, say, it's is that
exactly. So on the opting your level of green, if we had one that was matching the 12% of where the state is, why would anybody choose a different electricity supplier rather than just opt into the zero additional grid? Why do people go off on their own?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question.
So if let's pretend that we take the 5%, but that we have two options. You can do, let's say, 25%, or that you could do zero. And if that was one of our options, wouldn't people who wanted to save their $20 just do that? Or why would they ever choose not to pick the supplier that we've aggregated to?
Well, let me understand your question. You can't go lower than the
12%.
So you're going to do 12%, and that would be essentially for the aggregation, 0%. That would be the baseline.
Yeah, right.
So the 5% is 17%.
I understand that.
And the reason you would do that
why would someone generally like move the aggregation go down to your this no extra rate? I think the kind of simple answer is that there are other choices out there. Some people will want to go, and some people are already out there, and they feel, you know, for a lot of people, this is one more bill that they prefer not to look at, and this is great. Other people probably love, you know, looking at the market and seeing, can I deal? So I think that's probably where it comes down to for most people.
One of the companies that calls you every day of the week, that you have a choice.
So, folks,
we
have a question. In a world where in the last 10 years sometimes electricity rates really spike, sometimes it stays kind of flat. Has aggregation done better in certain markets than others? And
I don't know that I have information to answer that, but one of the things you can guarantee with this is that you have a stable price over the fixed term. So you are helping to hedge against, as Ann said, we can't know what basic service will be. And a couple winters ago, I think it was a really, really big spike. So I don't think it's done necessary. Yeah, I think when you have those really big spikes, it does even better. But so
I'll just put in the comments that I think we should absolutely investigate aggregation, and I hope we move forward. We'll see where we go in the coming months, but
okay, thank you. Any other council comments? Eric Olson is chairman of the Citizens Commission on Energy, and I would normally love to recognize you. I really want to move this because we have another committee coming in here. And what I'm hoping is we can bring this to a vote. This is a first step. It's not a heavy lift. What I would like to suggest is, because I did understand that there's not a requirement by statute, once we authorize this, that it come back to the council, that we condition our authorization on the matter coming back to council at the appropriate time, which I think is after the first, after the plan is developed and there's the first public hearing. Jack, we in general agree on that?
Yes.
Okay. Would somebody like to make a motion?
I'll move.
Okay.
What about?
Yes.
But even, I mean, that's a step in the right direction, because otherwise, when we were hearing we, I think everybody knows this, but it wasn't really we, it would be the administration.
Right, right.
And they could make every call once we authorized them to go ahead. And so I think you need to keep that in mind, because we had one incident that this committee was not happy about, and a decision that was made with the way some credits were dispersed. So I think what you just said about making sure that this comes back to us, I think that's a step in the right direction, but we will have no role unless we somehow make it clear that we want a role in the selecting of a consultant, because that's the second step in the process. So I don't know how other members feel about that, but if we authorize this tonight, and I do think that we should obviously investigate it, being investigated now as it anyway. It's not like they haven't had discussions about this within the administration. I'm sure that they have. This is, you know, no reason why we shouldn't vote to the docket item, but we don't necessarily have a role in the consultant. And I think that it would be wise for us to try and have some role, but maybe others are comfortable with that.
And how would you suggest we request a role in that selection? I mean, if there's a public bidding process, well, there's no money. There's not necessarily one, but there could be one.
Yep.
There's no money involved up front, but it would cost something in the program ultimately, or that money is paid by Eversource, period. We never direct it. Anything.
We pay it, though. Yeah. We pay it indirectly. It's put into the price.
But I think I'm not...
It's like any contract.
Not advocating that the city try to do this on its own without a consultant. But, Scott?
I was going to suggest just going to finance, too. Any chance to bring them in to the administration?
Is this going to finance?
Yes.
All right. We'll take care of that part of it.
No, that's So, the only condition I would like to put in here for right now is that once the plan is developed and there's at least one public hearing, or it could be before the public hearing, but in the early stages of developing the plan, so I'll look at members of the administration here for this, that we condition our authorization on this coming back to us for review.
So can we go beyond that and say that we would like it to be a collaborative process? And that when there's a draft of the plan, we'd like to see a draft of the plan. I don't know how that hurts to be collaborative about this.
To be specific rather than using a word.
Okay, so Councilor Gentile would like to see participating in consultant selection. I would like to see a draft of the plan before it goes to the public.
So maybe we, if I may, we condition our motion subject to presentation of the plan to the Public Facilities Committee prior to it being distributed to the public. And I want to be very clear that before we submit for state approval, that it has to come back here.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean we won't do it, but we need to have some oversight as to what's done and make sure it's done well.
Okay.
Not that it won't be, but...
Nadia, do you have that? Okay, we have a motion on the table with conditions. We ready? All in favor? That's unanimous. Thank you. We have taken the very first step forward. Patrick, for your time. I know you've spent a bit of time in the community discussing this with some of our green folks. And I appreciate that. I want to thank Andy Savitson and Berwick for joining us this evening. And that is the end of the first item. We are now we're joined by other members of the council who I think we'll introduce because you're here really for the next item. So I think we're going to let the room empty a little bit. We are exactly 1:00. Thank you everyone for coming and showing your support.
We didn't get what they promised, and it cost us more, and we didn't get the energy of it, it was humiliating for us.
And this is, I don't know if you remember it.
Remember that?
And you have the right to opt out of that. And that will be a fine policy decision, but we have to talk about it.
There are two reasons that we would do this. One is you get cleaner energy, and the other is to save money. And there may be people who don't care about one or the other.
They're combined in the same system, but it's clear they're not the same at all. I mean, the renewable energy is going to cost more money.
John Weiss is here with me.
Yes.
You have an open meeting. Would you like to guest?
Regular scheduled meeting of the program
Superintendent Fleischman requesting a vote of the City Council to complement the vote of the School Committee to authorize the Superintendent of Schools to submit to the MSBA FY17 Statement of Interest no later than April 7, 2017 for the consideration of Lincoln Elliott Elementary School as a major school building project after Cabot Elementary School. And we are joined by Diana Fisher-Gomberg of the School Committee, who, as I understand it, has a main role in facilities. Was not available this evening. We had some a conflict.
I actually was expecting Liam and Julie to be here, so
I thought there would be a presentation too. I got a strange email from Jonathan and their text or whatever they called, and he was being asked if somebody could be here at all tonight, since this is exactly the same, as he was told, as what you submitted earlier.
It's my understanding that the only thing that's really been changed is revising the enrollment figures, because that's a key part of the package, and now we have one more year of more recent enrollment information than we had last year. So that's really been the main change here.
Okay. So I'm going to open it for questions then. Barbara and then Carol.
Thank you. So what makes us think we'll be more successful time again?
It's a great question. I think you never really know year to year. We're hoping that we will be more successful. It always depends on the mix of schools that are applying, which we never know year to year, and it depends on the funding that the state has. So it's my understanding that we were encouraged to try again. And since this would be big money, as you know, the UCA funds about a third of the project, so that it's worth trying. But no guarantee.
Okay. Carol and Mark?
So I would think that one of the issues was they've given us a lot of money for a lot of schools recently. But did we get any feedback that maybe something should be changed?
Well, I know one of the things that that was the goal of this new draft was to really focus on enrollment and the overcrowded situation on the north side, because that's something that MSCA really prioritizes in addition to the conditions of the building. So I think last year the emphasis was more on conditioning the building, and now to strengthen the enrollment. Because, as you know, there's been a lot of north side crowding, not just in Lincoln Elliott, even though it's actually had the greatest growth in the last 14 years or so. 12 years, they have numbers from 2004 in there. So it's actually the biggest percentage increase, but it's right next to Horace Mann that's had big crowding, and Franklin's having a lot of crowding. So if we could expand the capacity of Lincoln Elliott, that would help not just Lincoln Elliott, but the whole
side. So we're focusing on what they still think is more important.
I'm fine with this. I mean, it's great. Is there any downside to submitting an application again, and maybe if you don't get it approved, submitting again?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm talking to other districts. They often had to keep reapplying for years until they finally get it, and then they
bring it. Except for the amount, there's some staff time involved in other processing, but it seems to be quite
difficult. Allison, and then Vicki, and then Greg. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed one. I missed three.
Alison, Roseanne, Vicki, Greg. So, my understanding that I'll call it the original Lincoln Elliott School is citizen education. And is that part of that probably when we do the contract and the threat at the end of the year?
So our current thinking, the proposal is to eventually have the current Lincoln Elliott school building used as green space after the current Lincoln Elliott community can move into a renovated Aquinas building. But this is really applying for funding partnerships to be able to renovate a school for the current Lincoln Elliott community. So while it's not a foregone conclusion, we're thinking it's going to be a remodeled Aquinas, but it could always be a remodeled Lincoln Elliott. And then if we're going to be, so say we do the remodeling of Aquinas, this is what we fully expect to do, and then we want to use the current Lincoln Elliott building as green space in the future, that would be a separate project from this MS school project.
But so the current project is to renovate the school completely, or is it more?
Well, by the school,
would
you mean the
Aquinas
building? No, it's to do the renovations necessary for the existing space.
Oh, okay.
But it wouldn't be like up to MSCA standards the way that we want to be able to renovate the Aquinas building for the Lincoln Elliott and preschool.
Well, that's
I don't want to step into tonight, but yeah, clearly once we get this up and going to be the Pines campus to be used for Lincoln Elliott and the preschool, then there's not going to be as much space in the parking
lot.
That's something that we actually have to do a negotiation with the MSCA once we were accepted in the process. So that's not determined yet.
But
given
the number that they like, right? Like, they tend to like a certain 450 kind of number.
Yeah, that's an argument so far, that they definitely like filling in some room, but not extra room, because every class is different. So So that ends up being a negotiation early on in the process.
And the timeline wants to be set to be
I think from last year, I think it was the same time frame last year, and we didn't hear back until early January or late December.
So you're expecting
not to hear that until December? Yeah. I'm assuming it's the same schedule as it was last year. I can check into that for you.
Let me go around the room. So, Ruth Ann, Vicki, Greg, Mark.
I just have one question, and that is are we planning on not moving forward with this unless we get FCA funding? In other words, do we have a timeline on when we need to get this done, or is moving forward at all dependent on our getting FCA funding for it?
I really hope
that
you get MSCA funding.
And does that throw us off? How would that throw us off if we don't?
Then, we could reapply again, or we could come up with alternate funding, which would mean that the city would bond for itself, and we do an override, and maybe we don't.
Has that decision been made or not?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Greg?
So if we bond for MSCA, it's not contingent on us getting a debt override.
Well, no, because you guys just bonded with.
Well, we bonded without a debt override.
Well, okay. This is our...
We will get funded.
It's not a requirement.
No. If that's the only way that your city or town can pay for its share, then we need to do it. But if we can pay for our share without that, then MCA will become effective.
But wait. Let's just take a step back for a second. I don't think that in order to receive state reimbursement, that you have to have authorized a debt override. You don't necessarily have to do that, because we got plenty of state reimbursement for Newton North, and we didn't do a debt override for Newton North. So I don't think it's a requirement.
But the issue is didn't have to
have
the money already.
Well, it was a matter of timing, and we felt we weren't going to get Jervis approved because we had just gotten Angel approved, and it was the timing, so we didn't even try, which is called definitely the right decision.
Right. But it wasn't because we couldn't
request
it.
Right. Right.
Okay, and then the second question, I guess, you alluded to this, Diana, was that
There are actually a number of factors that MSPA requires us to look at, and by us, I don't actually mean the school committee, I mean the school building committee. With MSPA funding, you have to set up a school building committee, which we're all familiar with now. It has some city councilors, school committee people, some building department people, it has community representation, they're always in public. And one of the first things that you do is you have the whole matrix of all the different key things that you look at and all the different possibilities, even if they're very remote possibilities, of where you might be able to put this school, and to really go through in a very structured public way.
But in your mind,
I mean, in our thinking, our proposal, we've got it in the finest, but we will certainly go through the whole process to examine every possibility and make sure that really is the best.
And just one final question. If it were that we
build
the municipal as finance, would
the finance be in the
current state
be
able to be a
student
there? I know that you're talking about building finance into a Lincoln-Elliot and making Lincoln-Elliot into something, and you consider the alternative, which is having finance in current state be a current state while one would rebuild Lincoln-Elliot or move or any other.
I mean, that's a possibility that, we might come up with through this process. I haven't thought about that. I mean, the others have. But it would also need work to be topical tomorrow. For example, it doesn't have a diminishing. They're an important elementary school, so it would still need work to do that. We like the idea of having Lincoln-Elliot and the preschool in one facility. It's a nice continuation of services for all the kids who go to preschool who continue to Lincoln-Elliot, and there is a higher proportion of Lincoln-Elliot kids at the preschool than any other school, so it's a really nice option to have that continuation of services and to share a little bit of staff, too. Which I think is better than having preschool share with Prince State, although that's not a terrible combination.
I think that's a reasonable policy goal and an organized goal, but if the cost of using clients as a swing space is lower than having to rebuild another swing space in Lincoln-Elliot, I would think that differential would be something that would be considered.
Can I make a suggestion that that what is before us tonight is just to decide whether or not we want to authorize the SLI to go forward, and then all these things are going to come up when we, there's going to be a lot of decision making at that time, and I know we all have long agendas,
so.
But no, I just have a sense that I think the proposal sounds to you are saying that the client is
well, we still have to go through the regular process of looking for sites. So it has to be a phase. The MSBA requires a phase of feasibility assessment for multiple sites.
From the acquisition point, from the time of the acquisition point, the administration has been very kind of, I think, ahead of itself, like saying, or ahead of us, saying this is kind of what's going to happen without any input necessarily, at least not considering for the public council, or whether that's what I'm going to be or not. It sounds like that was still a question when maybe the administration place you thought of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You've got to be careful to make clear what's open.
So that you don't want to support this because of how it's written, I mean, that's fine. I just think that all I want to do is move on the item that we have before us, which is, should the school committee submit another statement of interest to the MSBA so that they may try again to become a part of the MSBA process?
Well, this is here, I have no problem.
Uh-huh.
My question for them is, what is in submission to MSBA, whether it commits us to saying find a site, sounds like it doesn't.
Supposedly it's exactly identical to the previous submission, which although I went through this, I didn't remember that it was identical. That's what I've been told.
Can I just answer one thing that Brad asked about why service is done differently than came here and have it? Keep in mind that MSBA really likes to give funding to those schools that are in terrible condition. You'll remember Anger and Cabot were in really bad condition. But service wasn't too bad. It was just small and was centrally located. So it's a great place to still figure out getting our enrollment challenges. But I think we didn't think service would get the funding. Not only because of Anger, but because of the condition, Washington D.C. at
Alright, Mark, is
that? So I just wanted I'm fine with the statement of interest, but as your current thinking is, we're telling the MSBA Lincoln Elliott is our next highest priority, and are we telling them that we don't know where Lincoln Elliott will be located, or are we telling them it's going to be at Aquinas?
I think we're saying that Aquinas is a strong option.
And what are we saying about the current building? I mean, that part of the premise is
that it's a very, very bad fit. It goes into a lot of detail.
I remember reading that. So the current building's in bad shape. We're interested. Give us money, and then we're going to figure out whether we work the current building or we move it to Aquinas.
Correct. Or some other site.
Mm-hmm. That's the gist of what we're asking for.
Right.
I'm going to echo just two comments from my colleagues. I mean, I think Councilor Fuller is exactly right. I'm at a loss why it would cost $60 million to sue Aquinas, which is a 1960s, relatively good shape building. That seems like an extraordinary amount of money. And I do share Councilor Schwartz's concerns about location, and while I appreciate that it's nice to have a continuum for preschoolers. We have 15 elementary schools, so the continuum is not going to be for that many kids,
mm-hmm.
and far better that we spend our money prudently than we do it because we think it's a good idea to have a continuum for some small subset of preschoolers. So that's just my thought.
We'll look carefully to see what the different costs are, because I'm not sure, you know, which right now, I can't really speak to exactly which would be less expensive.
I think the problem is that the public perception has been, I think Councilor Albright said this, that, you know, we bought Aquinas, we're going to move that there, that's our plan. It's like, well, wait a minute, we haven't had any discussion about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the perspective that you want to bring back to your colleagues
mm-hmm.
is that that's going to be an issue for us.
Mm-hmm.
I think you kind of had to say something when you bought it. So it's the same.
couldn't say I'm going to buy an aquarium, so I'm not 100% sure what I'm going to do with it. I don't know how many times.
No, we knew what we were going to do with it, but we were told that we could move in.
Yeah,
all we're going to do is build it.
I don't want to get into the weeds, the chair said, but you know, you've got site constraints, you aren't a gymnasium, and I'm not paying $50 million or anything at all.
Yeah, that's the only thing.
There's no site plan to this point.
Yeah.
We're talking about buses, and we still don't have a site plan.
It would be great to get clarification directly from the school department, from Liam, I suppose, about the actual the money that's been spent so far and whether or not that's included in that $60 million
figure.
Yeah. Get that right away.
Yeah, I'll find out about that. And the more that we really, you know, once we really get the process started to really have architects look at that building, we'll know really what the right cost is. Even though it is in good condition, it's not set up as an elementary school, like the classrooms are way undersized, and so there's going to be changes to bring it up to MSBA standards.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, over there.
One of the decisions might say that we have to MSBA take into consideration is the condition of the school. Isn't it better for them to designate the school as a building out?
Well, it's the home school. It's the current school that they are asking about. So we have to describe the current Lincoln Elliott, which is actually a great school to describe because it has a lot of problems. So we can make a good case that it's with the state investment.
Gotta love this.
Okay. Yes, Wayne.
So this is a little bit different than what we've done in the past. I understand that when you get into the process, you're supposed to look around or whatever, but we knew what we were doing at Asia. We knew what we were going to do at Zurbis, and we made it clear. We knew what we were going to do at Cabot. We weren't going anywhere else, and we knew that they were going to be either total teardowns or what we did at Cabot. This is a little bit different in that we're kind of like trying to get money from the state for an area. And I don't see how that can be helping us with the state. Also, if there's a potential for a building to be turned into swing space, if I was on the other side, I'd be saying the last thing I want to do is give the city of Newton money so they can build some swing space. So that can't be helping our application. So I don't know how you can do that. Plus, you haven't even voted on this yet, have you?
We're voting on Monday. But we're not asking for money for swing space. We're asking money for renovating or building a building for the Lincoln Elliott community. And that might be in their current plot. It might be Aquinas. It might be somewhere else. But we have to go through the process, too.
Okay. It's just
through their process.
All right. And then, Nadia, if you could, I need to have George and or Maureen. If we're going to be expected in finance to vote on Monday night, we need to have some more somebody from the school department, you know, to answer these questions a little bit more specifically, especially the money part of it. Because I know there'll be some members of finance having, and I have a few questions. So if that could get passed on, because I mean, I don't want to slow down the process, but we need to get a few things answered.
Notice.
Okay. But if we're not.
No, I realize the school department should be at your meeting and.
Yeah, but it's more the questions that we're asking. I mean, the CIP and the numbers that Roseanne is quoting, they came. The administration put that together.
Yeah.
That wasn't
right.
All right. So they need to be. Josh needs to answer that, or Maureen needs to answer that. So we need them as much.
I agree.
I don't think that was good. What you just brought up, it feels like we're putting $10 million or whatever $1 million at risk by saying it's for the Lincoln Heights community versus for a specific location.
That's how we have to do it.
I think I understand that as part of the process. Because with every other school, even though we knew what we were doing, we were still required to look in a reasonable, within a circle. For other potential sites that
were
required part of their process.
And there was serious consideration at the Cabot project. There was a serious consideration looking for a real other site.
Other site or
other site,
new versus
outside
the
site.
It was such
a constrained
site.
I could have saved you a lot of time there.
I know, but they had to forever clear. We had a map, and we had to draw a big circle on the map and look at anything else within reasonable proximity.
Yeah, but that was controlling it. That was doing the drill. That was just.
I understand, but that's part of their process. So maybe occasionally, when they engage in that process, they do find an alternate. Right, and maybe this is one such case.
Do you want a motion?
Yes, I do. Scott has a
question. No, I only just want to say I think they're valid points, what Lenny was saying and what Councilor Cale was saying. At the budget meeting we were at last week, it was said we were highly encouraged to reapply. And I have to imagine that some of this conversation happened between the administration and the MSBA. That's what was explained to us about whether it's specific or whether it's area. I think all the questions are valid, but that was what I heard from the administration the other night. So they have to be at least aware of this quote unquote area situation. That's what I heard. And there were some others in the room here too that were here. So if that helps at all, I don't know. I just want to like.
Is there a dollar figure in the full proposal to a weed? Do we give the MSBA an idea of how much money we're going to be looking for? Mm-hmm. Not at all.
Because we can't, it's too early to say, because we haven't decided, exactly where the plot is, exactly whether we're doing a rebuild or a renovation.
And the program.
Before that goes to MSBA, do we have to have a close idea of those numbers?
No, that happens after we're accepted into the MSBA process. But
the
MSBA, after tonight's meeting and finance meeting, we can bring this to a vote. We have a motion to approve in public facilities. I don't want to jump the gun on you all, but if you're ready to.
Okay.
Public facilities from Mark Laredo, all in favor of moving this one step forward. We have 7 and an abstention.
The motion and programs and services. The motion and programs and services. All in favor?
I'm going to say this
Okay. So let's say the issue is coming. Carry that. Okay. After that. $400,000 from free cash for the purpose of designing streetscape improvements to the Walnut Street Newtonville corridor. We are joined by Lisa Hanna, senior city engineer, who is going to present this item.
As stated, this is $400,000 for design. This is the concept design, preliminary design, and final design for the Walnut Street area in Newtonville, otherwise known as Newtonville Square. I call it Newtonville Square. Some people call it Walnut Street Newtonville, but that's the area that we're doing. It also includes survey. The area hasn't really been surveyed yet for the topographic features. So this is $400,000 for Environmental Partners. Environmental Partners have been working in this area, this region, for a little while for the city on an on-call contract. They looked at Washington Street and Walnut Street. They designed Harvard at Washington Street, which is going under construction pretty soon. They've also been tasked to look at the Ted Crossing north of Trowbridge Street. So they are well familiar with the area here. The schedule is to complete the concept design by
by June, bring it before you all, and then proceed to preliminary design, final design for construction in the 2018 construction season. That's an aggressive schedule, but that's kind of where we're leaning. Of course, the mission is, the mission's aggressive. The mission is to have pedestrian station, wider sidewalks, streetscape, bike lanes, and throughput traffic, all which conflict with each other, but that's the design. That's the design challenge. So I'm not here to present the design. This is just the fun to get us into concept design.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we were expecting this, and so Susan is first, and then I'll go to the side.
So we have a consultant on board, because we had a first meeting and we had a walkthrough.
Yeah, they've been using their on-call services contract just to get the ball rolling here, because I know planning has had some meetings with the public. So we've been using that contract just to kick this thing off, just to kind of jumpstart it. But now we really need, you know, to get into the, you know, putting things on paper, concept design, preliminary design, final design.
So will these be the same design?
Same group, yeah. The same group.
And so, June is a very aggressive timeline. Concept. So there'll be another community meeting?
There's another community, yeah, within the package. There's another community meeting in...
What is that?
I guess I'll just read them in every room. Meeting 2 in April. They already had meeting number 1.
Yeah, we did.
Meeting 2 in April, and then the preferred concept meeting number 3 would be in June.
Okay.
So that's a kind of just because we need to nail down the concept and we can proceed to.
Okay, so my other question has to do with Washington Place. We're counting on doing this up to the bridge.
Yeah.
Washington Place was going to do the other side of the bridge.
Right.
But if there's no Washington Place, then, you know, I mean, the design from Walnut Street going this way ought to match what happens over there.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have any answer to that tonight because we're still not sure of the status of Washington Place.
No, why not?
Washington
isn't quite as much of an issue as Washington Place is because there's to be bike lanes and different kinds of things going on over there.
Is Washington Place off the table?
Not yet, but it's heading in that direction.
I mean, what we could do is, you know, increase their scope in order to include the north side of the bridge. Currently, it's not within their scope.
No.
But if that's the consensus of the city, maybe, you know,
I would
certainly
ask that you watch this process carefully.
Yeah.
If it looks like it's going south.
Yeah.
Maybe consider coming back to us to extend the scope.
Yeah, because that intersection in the ADA ramps associated with that is extremely critical to the city. These folks are not, you know, past the design Washington Place was. But yeah, we can certainly include that in the scope at a later date, should that be necessary.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Let me go this way. So, Cheryl, did you run? I sit on the CIC?
Yeah.
This scope has been on the CIC. Contributing to this at all, or is this just...
No, Austin Street was going to do the Austin Street streetscape up to Walnut Street, but not including the...
And then there was an amount of staff they were also putting
in. Are we using any of that?
Not for this.
Okay.
So I assume that Chapter 90 money will take care of the... bulk of this, that, and do we...
We're going to do that bonded in the city.
It's
not my call, but I would assume that the chief financial officer would want to bond.
Okay. That answers my question. So this is not Chapter 90 money?
We would spend our whole lot to come for this.
So, okay, just back to Austin Street for a minute. Does the status of Austin Street, whether it goes forward or not, does that have any impact on what the, how the design might be done? I know it's not the same exact stretch, but it seems to me it was a significant change to the area that could possibly impact the design, or maybe it doesn't.
Well, the design that these consultants are going to provide has to assume that the Austin Street project is happening. Does that have to do with vehicles, turns,
turns,
and everything? So let's
how do we do this?
And I know I didn't vote for it. I'm not wishing that it failed, but there is some question as to whether or not that project is going forward.
Yes.
It's a fair statement.
That's a fair statement.
So how does that fit into, I mean, if we're giving them the charge to plan on Austin Street going forward and it doesn't go forward, doesn't that somehow affect how you would design
it? Yes, it does. It affects traffic and traffic turning. Part of the concept design is to look at various options, right turn only from Austin Street, right turn only from Ville Ave. There's even been on the table thrown out, maybe make Austin Street one way. Is it one way westbound, one way eastbound, and make Austin Street one way. So it does. So you're right. You answer your question, yes, it is a fact, but we have to proceed as the Austin Street project is happening. Right. If it doesn't happen, it lessens the impact on these decisions. So at a later date,
we'll just tweak the design
at a later date if Austin Street doesn't happen. But the worst case scenario for traffic is that Austin Street does happen.
Well, right. So another way to look at that is that you're planning ahead for increased traffic.
Correct.
There's not really a reason you need to tweak the design to plan for less traffic.
They look ahead 10 years anyway. What's the traffic volume going to be 10 years from now? Yeah, it's like 2027. So they're looking ahead 10 years anyway.
Right. And one way
of things
could make a difference.
Yeah, it would make a difference. But when you need, if Austin Street doesn't happen, you may not need
it. Right, and Graham Place is going to become dead end.
This doesn't
work on Graham.
And I'm just going to have one question, but it really is in your area. West Newton is a lot of work, and that's happening first?
Correct. West Newton is happening first. The goal is to begin construction this fall and carry over into next spring summer. That's aggressive. Very aggressive.
I'm wondering if that might get delayed.
Depending on bidding and everything else, it may get delayed until next spring. Which may push this off a little bit, but we still have to proceed into that. We're setting aggressive schedules internally for ourselves to try to meet. If the construction pushed a little bit, that's because of weather, winter. I can't start a project in November. It doesn't make any sense. So I'd rather wait till maybe mid March, of course. So,
mm-hmm.
But I could start a project in early September. So it all depends on when they can finish the design, how much comments they get from the public, when can the bid go out, what's the bidding climate, and when's the best time to solicit bids and receive bids.
Okay.
So
this is the first step. Barbara?
Thank you. So it says that this is in the CIP for $3 million.
Yes.
Is that still what we think?
That's the target. Well, that's the target. We don't know. I'll say, when you ask the public what they want, they tell me what they want. so that's a challenge that planning department has to kind of weigh everything everybody wants and kind of come up with an optimum design that's affordable. That kind of pleases everyone, pleases most people, not everyone, but that's affordable. So the target is $3 million. I can't tell you what it's going to be or not, so we don't have a concept yet.
The consultants on this are environmental partners?
Correct, yes.
Who did West Newton?
West Newton is HDR. What we thought was they couldn't possibly do both at the same time,
So HDR is doing West Newby. We wanted another firm because this is going concurrent, essentially.
But I've heard, is Environmental Partners, are they the ones that did...
No, that was Woltech. Woltech did Auburndale.
No, not Auburndale. Harvard Street.
Environmental Partners is Washington and Harvard, yes.
They did that.
Yes, they did.
So So this is important, especially as we go forward through these different squares. It's how are we about, I mean, originally we were going to use WorldTech for everything. And I get the sense, I've never gotten a straight answer on this, that someone in the administration was not happy with WorldTech. And so therefore we have looked at these other companies.
Sure.
So how are we... how are we doing some kind of an evaluation process so that going forward and we get into these other squares that we know who we want to try and deal with?
Yeah, you're asking us if we had done a request for proposal on these particular two jobs. No, we had not. In these particular jobs, we know these consultants. We've worked with them in other capacities. In other venues, we know who they are, and we're comfortable with them. For Newton Connor, which is a much different animal, the big Newton Connor, not the small stuff we're doing currently, but the big Newton Connor, we would most likely go out with a request for qualifications and proposal for Newton Connor. That's a much bigger problem to solve, solving the circle goes around. But the circle goes on Crown Plaza and everything the public wants and expects because they still feel that they've been wronged in 60 years. And they remind us constantly that they were wronged 60 years ago from us. Right. But anyway, yes, we would go for a request for qualification performance for that particular job. We thought that these West Newton and even this one, this Newton bill was smaller than West Newton. We thought this was a small enough job that we could give it to a firm that we're comfortable with and they can get the design done correctly.
Yeah, I wasn't so much asking about requests for proposals, but if we're not going to do a request for proposal, I would think that we should have some kind of a rating system or evaluating system so that when we choose, like I get the feeling that if WorldTech raised their hand on one of these other future smaller jobs, you'd say no thanks.
We would reject it, correct. Again, the way the state law works is much different than procuring construction services, procuring engineering services. You don't have to do a request for qualifications, request for proposal. The city, the administration, public works, engineering division can choose the consultant that we feel is the best fit for the project in hand. Knowing these consultants, I've been in the business 37 years. I know these consultants. Jim Abondo knows these consultants. Nicole knows these consultants. I've worked with them in other capacities and other venues. So they're no strangers to us. So we have the ability to choose whom we think is the best for the job. Similarly with water and wastewater. Wastewater we use less than Sandstone. Water we use Taylor Tyler. Because we know these firms and we've been working with them for.
Well, hopefully before we get started on West Newton, we'll make sure we'll get Auburndale Square straightened out because it's still not straightened out.
Auburndale Square, they're still discussing concurrent block signals versus exclusive block signals.
All in favor? It's unanimous. Thank you very much. Next item is 5617. Matter of the mayor requesting authorization to add one full-time employee within the public works department to manage all detail requests submitted to the police detail coordinator.
Yay.
There was a letter in our package. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, this is a good idea. The debate was, does this belong in public works engineering? Does it belong in the police? We felt it belonged in public works engineering. Then I can control it. The issue is, we're all of us, including public works contractors, public works utilities, all the other contractors, National Grid, Eversource, and the developers are all fighting for police details.
there's no one coordinating them on a day-to-day basis. It's just, you know, first come, first serve, and if you don't get one, tough luck. So we thought it was a good idea to have a, and call it what you want, and you're going to call it a field construction coordinator, not a detail coordinator, call it what you want, but we felt a need to have someone on a day-to-day basis coordinate the police details with the police department and determine, you know, by priority, who gets the police details, how many do they get, and for how long do they get them. So we have a ranking system that we're developing based on the roads, it's based on the road classification. We put it on a dead-end street, you really don't need a police detail, but on Washington Street, certainly you do. So it depends on the location. We want to give priorities to city contractors over, you know, private contractors, and that's what we're ironing out now. There's only so many police detail officers available on a particular day, so we felt the need for a coordination position.
Is that a debate regarding city work versus private work? I mean, we have
it's really prioritization. I mean, how, you know, someone has to prioritize, you know, who gets the police details and who waits a day. And that because there's only limited amount, there isn't unlimited police detail officers.
Well, I just want to put on the table, because I know people have lots of questions all of a sudden, but yeah. You know, there's a lot of construction work that's ongoing that's held up for weeks on certain occasions.
Yes.
That we would like to see go forward as
finished.
So I wanted to put that on the table,
yeah.
And then I have a whole lot of hands going.
The duty of this person, this incumbent, we'll have to figure that out. He'll have to, on a day-to-day basis, he or she will have to figure that out, you know, who gets the priority, what is the priority, can some crew live without a detail because they're on a street that really doesn't need one, or they only need one, not four on the sergeant. So that's the whole mission of this.
Okay. I'm going to go this way this time, so everybody raise hand and one from Mark first.
So, how many details are there in a typical day?
Oh, I don't have that information. The police would have that. I don't know.
2, 10?
Oh, no. We're talking in the 10 to 20 to 30 range or something like that.
I'm all for coordination. So why is this a full-time job? What is this person doing that requires full-time work?
You also have a person in the police department that's responsible for doing it. So it's more than just one position.
I don't know, is the police department person full-time, the detail coordinator?
Oh, I believe he is, yeah.
Full-time uniformed police officer is coordinating detail?
He does other things.
So what is going to take 40 hours a week of a person's time to coordinate detail?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, he doesn't need 40 hours a week to coordinate the detail.
Just full-time position.
The position will also help in the engineering division, in my office staff, answering the questions and concerns of developers, customers when they come to the counter, helping me with counter support, helping me with the telephone answering duties.
But that's not what the request is for.
Well, the request is for a full-time position. The request is for one FTE. It's for one full-time position.
I'm not comfortable with a request that says we need a full-time person to coordinate detail, and I want a much better understanding of what the needs are that are being currently in the department and what are the unmet needs, and this doesn't come yet.
Yeah, we are currently drafting the job description for this position. We haven't completed that yet.
Shouldn't we see that before we appropriate funds?
Well, you're appropriating a full-time equivalent position. We haven't graded this out, so we're not asking for funds yet.
Did
you
come back for funds?
We would have to go to finance.
Well,
it says you're covering funding from attrition.
Yes.
So that's the cover up between now and June 30th.
If this gets approved, they can hire the person right away.
We have salary surplus to get us through now and June 30th.
We're going to have a filled position in the budget.
It'll be in the FY18 budget.
Okay, thank
you. That's a very good question. I understand your question exactly.
I'm going this way. Barbara or Scott?
No. Yes, thank you. And I hope that many will figure out all the finances. You said about that it's somewhat discretionary what in terms of this person will now be able to say, well, this is my question actually. I thought it was there were some police union rules about this, but can this person say on that street you don't need three officers on their cell phones or on that street? You know what I mean?
This person will coordinate.
I thought that was, are there rules about that?
No, this one. The answer to your question is this person will coordinate with Lieutenant Walsh to figure out on a day-by-day basis how many police details you really need on a particular street for a particular project at any time. That's the goal. Because what's been happening is they've been on a certain project, they're putting four police plus a sergeant. But then another project, the attorney that contract away because they're not enough police. So this person is to work with the police department to determine what's really needed, what's the optimum amount. Do you really need four and a sergeant? Can get by with two, can get by with three based on the street. And we're ranking all the streets based on functional design classification. And then we're coming to an agreement. We're meeting weekly with the police department on this. And coming to a mutual agreement as to, you know, the type of street, how many police details you need for that street based on the work. If you drop to the side of the road, it's much different than working in the center of the road. So that has to do with how many police details you have as well.
So there, and maybe I should be asking someone different. Will the police department say, by our rules, we must have X, Y, Z?
No, their only rule is when you have four. If you need four officers, you need a sergeant supervising those four officers. If you need three officers, you don't need a sergeant.
Okay.
So there is no set rule other than the four plus the supervisor.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Scott? No? Funny?
So, I am not opposed to you getting an extra position in your department if I really think that you need it, okay? Because, truth be told, you work your rear end off for the city. You do a good job. You're one of the guys that I know if I call to get some information or to help a constituent that you got to get back to me. You're going to do the best you can, okay? And so I like to help people like that because they help me. However, I have real reservations about this position. And I think that what we should do is, rather than trying to deal with this tonight, this should be part of the budget discussion. This isn't something that, you know, has to be dealt with right away, because the problem is, it isn't the coordination. If we don't have the bodies. You know that as well as I do. We don't have enough officers that are willing to work details. If you talk to the chief or anybody else, he'll say that the younger officers have a different attitude towards this. They're entitled to have a different attitude. My colleagues or my age group, they were animals. If they can make an extra detail, they're going to work it. And today they have a hard time getting enough police officers to work the details. It's not so much about coordination. And for the life of me, I don't understand how we have to have two people coordinating police details. It's just, I don't see where we need to have that much staff working on that. It's a different problem. And I can just imagine a guy in public works trying to tell a police officer that, no, we don't really need somebody over at Elliott Street, I think we should put them over here. That's going to be a disaster. Okay? And so I think we really need to talk this through. I want to hear from the chief how they can't coordinate, why they can't just coordinate this themselves. What am I missing? Why can't the police department...
It's definitely blocked.
And one of the problems that we have right now is that we're trying to use auxiliary police officers to help to address the shortage of uniformed officers to do these details. You know, they're pretty, I won't go as far as what you said, but it's not heavy lifting, okay? It's not heavy lifting. And we're not getting cooperation from one of the unions, because we could have auxiliary officers out there helping to deal with this problem. So I'm not giving anybody any additional staff while we've got a union blocking our ability to try and solve the numbers problem, okay? And that's what's going on right now. So I just think that we need to have a bigger discussion about this, and it should take place during the budget process.
My response would be...
Yes.
Where are you?
I had to learn. It was getting late. My response is, on one hand, since the number of police detail officers is limited, we do have to do a better job in coordinating those officers on the projects in the construction field. My second answer is that engineering and public works knows the projects in the field. We know the contractors, we know what they're doing on any day, within the public right, on any given day, on anything, we know what they're doing, we know who they are, we know what their task is. The police don't know. If they don't know Trilenium from National Grid, you know, from Public Works Utility Division, they don't know the scope of the work. We know the scope of the work. So we're in a better position knowing the contractors and knowing their scope and what they're trying to do in any given day to coordinate those police details on their behalf. Police don't know. They told us they didn't know. Lieutenant Walsh tells us. He doesn't know what their scope is. He doesn't know what Trilenium is doing differently than Feeney Brothers is doing differently than KJV's crews. And they don't know. So all they're doing is providing manpower. We know the job. We know the crews. We know the mission. So we're in a better position to coordinate a police detail.
In other words, to prioritize where they should go.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have heard, I don't know everybody who's out in the field either,
yeah.
But we have heard from some of the work that we really do want to go forward effectively, like our water and sewer work, that sometimes they are stopped because they don't have the detail. And maybe there's a detail on a side street that, you know, could be redeployed.
Yeah.
I don't know that. I guess for me, it's only a few months worth of an FTE, if you feel to be right, because then we're going to go into
budget. Already in the budget, yeah.
Right, we are going to go into budget.
Yeah.
We only have a few months before
yeah.
we start talking about
yeah.
budget, and only, it's only until July
yeah.
before the new budget kicks in. So I guess maybe one thing that's sticking here is that this isn't all this person is going to do, and if you, it sounds like you need to make a case for a full-time position that is more than this. Clearly, you don't have a staff person to do this work,
right.
what I'm hearing,
right.
but I don't understand what the rest of this person's job is.
Well,
and by the way, what would the skill set be that you would be?
It would be a construction coordinator, someone who knows GIS, can map the construction zones on a day-by-day basis, someone who knows Microsoft Project, who does project scheduling, it's that type of construction schedule, construction project coordinator.
So is that useful also for example, you've got a big roads program coming up and you're starting to put that together. It's an enormous amount of work to
yes.
get from now to hitting the ground in,
yes.
in July.
Yes.
Is that something that this person would be working on?
What you have to realize is that if this position is approved and a body is in this position, that body is going to do this. This is going to be his primary mission, his primary job. I'll have him do other things as well, like I try to allude to. This person will go on vacation. He'll have special leave. He'll have, you know, floating holidays. He won't be in the office on certain days. Someone has to cover for him on certain days. That's my office
okay.
manager. That's the other person in the office. But the flip side is also true. When my office manager is out, someone has to cover for him. So this person would be available to cover for that person who's out. Yep, that's a certain, that's my job is to, you know, ensure that I have the coverage that I need when this person is out on a holiday or out on a vacation day or out on a sick leave day or out on a special leave day or a floating holiday.
I know there's two more questions, but I was going to suggest that if we're able to bring this to a vote this evening, that we might draft a more comprehensive description.
I am drafting.
We don't even have a salary range. When have we ever approved an FTE without a salary range?
Yeah.
Let's start there. And again, it's March. We're starting the budget in the not too distant future. It should come up during the budget discussion. But anyway.
Okay.
I'll be quick. I can see that this is an issue that has opened up a couple of cans of worms. We've got union issues, we've got staffing, we've got projects that are being held up because we don't have enough people yet, we don't have the bodies, but the unions don't want anyone but their union to be covering, and I think this is a bigger issue than we certainly are going to solve at this table. I agree that I would like to see more detail on including a salary range and what the job description will be, but I think that this I can see that this whole business needs to be looked at, and we may not have the right solution for brief detail the way we are handling it now.
Okay,
so. Mark, it's hard to ask my first question because it did say a full time just to do this. So it's obviously not. And
there will be other duties.
So obviously, so we do need a job description. I have no doubt that you need an extra body. So will you prioritize student projects over other things if they're not emergency? I mean, ransom location. I mean,
that really depends. It's on a day by day basis, that depends. Yes, I would like my person to prioritize.
Because you can tell him what the priorities are.
Her. Yes, but you have to look at the city holistically. Because. Something that National Grid is doing,
right.
They have an emergency gas, class one gas leak, obviously the
right, that's the priority.
In general, the mission would be prioritize city contractors and city utilities and highway division.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm going to wait to hear what we have in finance, but I'm fine with an extra SME in your department.
And then...
So what happens in the winter when you don't do nearly as much project with this person?
In the winter, we don't go into winter mode. We continue with engineering duties. We're clearing work for the next season. He was this gentleman. Person,
this woman
person would help us we're planning the work for next season, if you will. We're measuring roads, we're measuring sidewalks, we're looking at ADA ramps. We're looking at the entire city for the next construction season. This person would help us because we do need that help in planning the work.
Okay, so that's a part of the job description.
That's it.
Okay, so my second question is, what will you do if we waited and did this through the budget season and we don't get this person until, let's say, June? What impact would that?
It would be business as usual. It would be status quo, and that we'd have a difficult time coordinating the limited police detail office.
Yeah,
it'd be status quo.
Who's doing it?
The town of Walsingham.
No, in your office.
No one.
They're not talking to someone in your office.
Oh no, because we don't schedule police details. The contractor schedules. The contractor calls them the night before and says, I need police details for Washington Street. And in the morning.
They don't consult with you at all?
No. that's the issue. They don't consult with us at all. No.
So I think that you need somebody, and I think you're probably going to need somebody during the construction season when it starts up, which is probably So it would be, I mean, I don't know if you could write the job description and get the salary level.
I've already started.
Before it goes to finance.
Salary has to go to the executive office.
So, could it be done before it goes to finance?
I'm not so sure. It goes to executive office and HR.
Each individual contractor currently calls the police detail duty desk the night before to ask for police details. No one's coordinated.
I bumped into Lieutenant Walsh here the other day as we were walking out. And I said, "So what are you doing here?" He said, "I'm here at the coordinator."
We're having council now.
Yeah, so who's dealing with it? You?
Oh, it's me and Darryl and Dave and Matt Woodruff and sometimes the commissioner and Shane.
We're currently having
weekly meetings with them, and that's why this fell out of the weekly meetings.
The other thing I would have is, would be inclined to vote for this tonight so we could get to finance, because I think a lot of the questions sound like they're more financial. Yeah. It sounds like there's support on the table to have it, but that doesn't necessarily mean finance is going back.
Yeah.
They hold it, budget season, whatever, but I think we should get it to the domain.
Would you like to move it?
I'll move it.
Wayne?
How often do we shut down projects on a given day in this city?
I don't have that answer, but I know that contractors have been told, no, you can't work today, you have to work tomorrow. So on any given day, there may be a contractor doing, it's usually private work for a private developer on a private home, that they don't have a police detail, they need one. Sorry, you can't work today, you have to shut down, and you have to come back tomorrow. We'll have these people see tomorrow, not today. That happens just about every day to someone. I don't have, police will know that, I don't have that.
My experience is that is a very rare occurrence.
I've been told that it wasn't. That's what the police are saying.
And that they are generally saying, you do what you have to do. I just don't want this committee thinking that jobs, especially important city jobs, are being shut down for 2 weeks at a time, because that's just not what happens. It did happen
in the Nexus project.
In the what?
The Nexus project.
What Nexus project?
The large development on Cottage Street. It did happen in my area on Cottage Street over and over and over again, even once we had a problem with the contractor, but once he started asking, and we asked, because the problem was he asked, he didn't get one, he went to work anyway, we shut him down. We came to the police to shut him down because the neighbors complained.
Yes.
So, you know, I know what happens in my area, it can't be only happening in 4-5. So I'm going to suggest, thank you, I know Mark has this, and hopefully we should get his son. I would like to get this off the public facilities agenda, but if others disagree, here's what I think is that, you know, what our job really is here is I'm listening to a department that needs additional help. This still has more process to go through, and there's information missing. There should be a job description in here that we're looking at, not just a discussion and a letter. That's apparently only part of it. But I would ask for a motion to approve this subject to second call. You don't want to do it.
No, but why would you do it? You have to go to finance.
Is everybody going to abstain because they don't have a job description? So otherwise, it would
that's
be
fine.
Subject
I'll
to second call.
I think most of the questions need to be
I agree. I agree. But I just don't want it to come out of here with a totally
a negative vote or everybody abstaining. So, is everybody else?
I think we should move it to get it financed so that they can deal with it, because we're approaching the construction season now, and this is clearly a need.
You can do what you want, but with all due respect, the job description and what this individual is going to be doing 365 days a year is really the responsibility of public facilities. And what Lou is telling us is that this person, the majority of their time, is going to be spent doing something other than what the docket item reads. The docket item talks about coordinating police details, but Lewis told us that they're going to, even during the height of the season, they're going to be doing other tasks, because you don't need to work 40 hours a week assigning details. And then in the off season, he's going to be doing something totally different. So if we're going to have a process, if we're going to be increasing positions in the department, and I started off this by saying, if I was going to give somebody a position, I'm happy to give it to him. But we need to know what this person's job description is, because the majority of their time is not going to be spent on what the docket item says. That's this committee's job.
If the job description is going to be formulated, then we should do that. Yeah, I agree with that.
All right, then we'll hold it.
Let's hold
it. We'll hold it for the job description.
I'll move to hold.
My counter argument would be I'm trying to state that the majority of the time would be spent on, if 51% of the time would be spent on police detail coordination. So
what about
the winter is a different animal.
Right, so we're talking about year-round. Okay.
You're talking about
so, all right, I'd really love to bring this to a close. So I think it's going to be held at the will of the committee. I think, you know, the job description missing here, I would have just heard you that you need somebody in your office and waited for the job description, but we'll hold it, we'll take it up at the next meeting.
Okay.
And we'll have a job description. So we'll do that.
It won't slow down the completion of the process. That I can tell you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Because we weren't taking it up Monday anyway. Because I need to have the police chief come in and explain why his department can't coordinate police details.
Okay.
That's ridiculous.
We have a motion. All in favor? Opposed? Thank you. It's unanimous. Okay, so we have one more item for you. We have discussion and two things to NAM.
We're holding
the 400,000, the 350. I'm going to hold the 350. We don't need to pay for that, but I did want to have a brief discussion. Thank you very much. Okay, item 5917, to appropriate $350,000 for construction of a parks and recreation / police building. Was going to have a big crew here tonight, but I had a conversation with first Josh and then Jim McGonigal about this, and they're actually in a powwow with Parks and Rec as well to rethink this whole thing. And I wanted to just put this out for the committee. When this came up, I looked it up, and it was not in this year's CIP originally. It was in the supplemental for this year as a Parks and Rec, a metal building for Parks and Rec. It's just in the supplemental for this year. So somehow this changed, and I think probably a lot of us weren't paying that close attention. I wasn't, to what this meant. And they're proposing to put what Josh describes as a pre-engineered building on the Elliott Street site. So for a very long time, I've been concerned that unlike our other departments, unlike the school department and the fire department and the police department and the water and sewer stuff, we haven't been looking at our citywide operations as a citywide operations and looking at all of our sites and, you know, what our needs are and how the sites are used. Juanita started to do that for trash and recycling and all of those facilities. But there's multiple needs. It's only come up this year, and I have been talking to the police chief, I'm sure others have as well, about his interest in having an outpost on the south side of the city. I don't know this, but I might have been the first person to suggest that if we had a site plan, a better organized site plan for the Elliott Street site, which includes the DPW yard, a bunch of buildings, which I'll just briefly describe in a minute, another site adjacent to it where public buildings is, and that fall next to the fire station, and it's in disarray. But I thought if we really could do a thoughtful assessment and plan for this site that is forward-looking and organized and efficient, might be able to fit an outpost for the police department, too. I don't know exactly what he wants, but he's talked about some kind of customer service and having an officer over there. As you notice, we didn't have anything in the packet but a memo, so we don't know what is this building, what are the specs for it, what's it going to be used for, how many staff, what is the police element of this, and there's no site plan and no assessment of current facilities. So I just want to put a couple of facts on the table, and folks are thinking about this at this point. There are two substantial buildings on the Elliott Street site. Combined, they're about 25,000 square feet, 15,000, 10,000. In the 15,000 square foot building, three people work full time. In the 10,000 square foot building, six people work full time. There's a bunch of folks who come in and out. Over the years, the back building, which used to be an incinerator, and we spent money to renovate it for offices, has been used to collect everybody before snow operations, as you probably know this too, you know, so there's a big conference room there. But there's a lot of unused space. There are field operation personnel who come in and out of these buildings at different times, but not very many, just a few more for each building. Then you have the public building bunker, which is what I call it, because I spent a lot of time over there. The modular. It's a modular and a storage facility. So in 2,200 square feet, there are 11 full-time people. And we know how hard they work. And if you go in and you'll see they use every square inch of this place, and it's not very world country, but it's kind of close. And then and attached to that is a storage area, which also has a small shop. And in total, there's 40 people who use this building. There's 30 booths who come in and out and use the shop and whatever. And next to that building is a site where there's just a lot of parking, which used to be where we had our temporary fire station. So it's not physically, and you can't walk from that part over to DPW sites because there's a fence and so forth, and the grades change a bit. Anyway, then along Elliott Street, there's a long row of garages. It's a flat roof structure. It's very long, just brick. I mean, it's holding itself up, and it's stuffed full of stuff, and there's a couple mechanics bays, a small mechanics bay, probably smaller than what Parks and Rec is thinking about. But now we also have the solar canopies over there, the big, tall solar canopies, which also can provide some degree of shelter for trucks, as long as the trucks don't have, aren't filled with salt. So we don't need, and Jim, I talked with Jim McGonald, and says now he realizes he doesn't need all of those garage bays for the stuff that's in it. And he's in the process of thinning out and getting rid of stuff they don't need or that's broken and no longer used, and cleaning up the yard. He's almost finished with it was an enormous area of excavate, and there's still going to be a rock crushing operation over there, and they're going to take the excavate, but on a regular basis, they're going to be turning it over, so there will only be one pile, not three. And there's still snow storage over there, which you might even find another site. So Jim is completely on the same page and thinking, you know, there's really they can think about how else they could use the site even just today and whether or not they need another building at all. So he and Bob the Rubis are getting together with Josh. If they can pull some of the trucks out of these days, they might be able to create a big enough mechanics day. I don't know what they're going to come up with, but the point is that they're going to sit down and think about this now. And if there's going to be a customer service entrance over at the Elliott Street Guard, that really needs to involve a site plan and a real thinking about, because right now, I don't know if you've been over there, but there's a wide gated entrance where the trucks go in and out. Everybody goes in and out, but it's mostly for trucks. And if you're going to have customers come in, so citizens come in as well as trucks and this construction type work and movement going on in there, you really want to think about how you're going to lay out the site to allow that to happen safely.
He's talking to them, smack the plan for this area, and not just that there are other parts of the city where there are trucks and things happening. So they should look at them.
And they
couldn't put buses there because they were trucks, but you're going to have old ladies coming into the police department.
The bus thing actually, I came up in a conversation with Ruth Goldman, and I was thinking about this because I was thinking about the site over the last few years. And, you know, if public buildings, so the building with the ziggurat roof is an old stable, but it's a heavy-duty masonry building. And there's a big loft in it, which is bigger than the offices. It's bigger than the offices that the buildings department has now. What if we renovated that space, gave them some decent offices, got the bunker and the modular off that site?
So the bottom line is we can save ourselves a lot of time here if we agree that we need to move to Holden until...
Well, we're definitely holding it.
Yeah.
But it definitely should be. We'll be looking at the whole city. There's a place they need to...
Even when the snow operations are going on in that building, I mean, that's when it's fullest, in that big cavernous space. But I think that space could be better utilized than it is now.
Okay.
Thank you,
Len. I'm fine with holding it, but there's two things to please keep in mind. Number one, if you get into all this planning, the next thing you know, you're going to get a request for $350,000 for feasibility and design, okay? So I don't know about saving money. Secondly, and more importantly to me, we have known, you have known, as a member of Reuse, that it has been made clear to us for 3 years that Parks and Rec was closing down and operations were moving to Elliott Street. So I don't care where they go or how the best way to do it is, but that needs to happen, and that needs to happen now, sooner rather than later. We've kept operations there at Crescent Street now for 2 years, which is fine. There's no reason to have moved them, but we've known for a while now that it's being moved. That's always been the plan. Whatever they're doing,
we need a plan.
They figured it wasn't going to be such a big deal to move. It's not a big operation. Anyway, I don't really care. You come up with a better plan, but if we're not going to move this item along and there's a better plan, then somebody needs to stay on them to make sure it gets done so we can move this operation.
Well, I'm very interested in this, and I agree with Cheryl. There wasn't any planning that went on that. You're right. 3 years ago, we knew we were going to close that down, and I thought the departments were going to be, and the administration would work out how that was going to work.
Did they show you where they were going to put this building?
No, they're
going to plop it down. No, I know, but they must have some idea where they were going to put it.
I don't think so. Well, especially now that it includes a police outpost that supposedly is going to incorporate customer service. How are you going to bring people into that site?
How many Parks and Rec employees?
I asked God, nothing. There was nothing showing.
Well, all I'm saying is we got to hold their feet to the fire to make sure that they're working on whatever you want, because I mean, the operation has to be moved, so...
I understand that. I understand people have to keep working, and, you know, there's only the mechanic phase and whatever it is they need, but I would like some information about, you know, what it is they need. You know, what is the list of needs, and you know, let's actually look at it. Let's actually make sure they're looking at it and comparing notes and making sure they have the spaces that they want. Frankly, if this turns into something that it requires a feasibility assessment and, you know, programmatic needs for three different departments and figuring out how to deploy them across the city, but principally at Elliott Street Yard, I would have no problem with that. That would give us a clear direction. And we have these two buildings over there that, you know, are practically...
My question was, how many employees are there at Parks and Rec that would need to move over?
I don't know.
And I don't know how many trucks.
It's
a truck, three trucks, right? Right. It's equipment, but, and then it's, if I had a guess, I'd say, like, maybe 20.
Yeah.
Not a big, it
that
shouldn't be,
doesn't have a big
it shouldn't be a big, it shouldn't be a big job, a big effort to move this thing, you know?
No, but there should be some thought that goes into
it. No, I understand that.
The new building is what's the big deal, and if it's going to also try to incorporate, I think it's way too early to think about whether there's a customer service opportunity over there. I don't think that's a bad idea.
No.
And I don't think it's a bad idea, actually, for more than the police department. I sent pictures to Scott. I've gone over to look at what Needham does in some other communities, but Needham is, you know,
But I think the two things are actually separate. They don't necessarily work best together. I mean, I don't know, there's been discussions about putting it at Emerson, putting the police presence at Emerson at the community
center.
That might be fine, but my point is that the primary reason behind this request for money is to move the Parks and Rec Operations Division. If that's what the plan is, I don't want to see it get hung up over police.
I understand. And Jim McGonigal understands this, and Josh understands it, and, you know, I'm sure Bob DeLubis doesn't have it.
You could be 100% right that they could move some stuff around and use their existing building
right.
to get
they
this done.
They just have to figure it out, and they've got 3 years.
So I get it, but I just don't want them to take another year trying to figure it out, that's all.
I think there's some pressure on.
Said
he has no intention of shutting down the buildings or taking down the buildings at Crescent until through the design process and
right.
so forth anyway, so we have that time. By July, if they need it, we actually have a temporary inflatable fire station that could be used for something, you know, for the rest of the year.
I don't want that.
I know.
Like some garage.
You can build a ski slope in it. So we're holding this.
So you have their attention, what you're saying.
Yep. I believe they do. So, Barbara?
No,
I'm going to hold it. In all favor, hold. All right, thank you very much. The next two items, the intention is to NAMM.
So moved.
Why? review of the identified non-criminal disposition in Chapter 17 of the ordinances was voted no action necessary in finance, PS&T, and programs and services, and I believe the reason is we're about to enter into another recodification.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we never got to this.
Lyle.
What happened?
No, we have to appoint someone. Remember the recog committee?
Mm-hmm.
That was 5 years. Lyle and I did it last time. And it was a huge project last time. This time it's not going to be a huge project because we went through the whole everything last time. So we need to volunteer.
Okay, well, we don't have to decide that now.
No. Okay, well, we
have to decide. Item 257-12, do I have a motion to NAN?
So moved.
All in favor? Thank you very much. And 100-15 was the previous matter on municipal aggregation. We were just considering it as of a year ago. Norton Sandhill and Larry Albright requesting that the administration pursue municipal aggregation of energy
cards. Of course, you want to pass one rec on that.
Yep, there you go. And now we know what those are. So, all in favor of NAN on that item? It is unanimous.
Good.
Thank you very much.
How come I didn't see that crowd jump up tonight and object when someone basically said that renewable energy is more expensive? It doesn't have to always be more expensive, does it? I was surprised that there wasn't a big gasp in the audience. Because that was what we said, that renewable energy is more expensive. So if you go plus for high...
It probably is now because it's not subsidized like the fossil fuel. Yeah.
So just a question.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a vicious attack. renewable energy.
Well, who's the coming around?
Right? From all the people in the room who want us to go, much higher percentages.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah, 25% more.
Yeah,
that's fine. Somebody just had my zero on their percentage.
Is what are we willing to pay for it?
Because that's what she has with her current program.
Wow.
Yeah. Why is this in this? Because we have the other item. We already took action on the municipal aggregation. No, this is
the retard one.
Oh, the retard? Because we're entering another retard.
So because we haven't done it in 5 years, we're going to just...
Well, we're not going to do it in 2 weeks.
Is it going to be docketed or something?
Well,
the other three committees have now ended. If we act on it, then we have conflicting reports. Right. Don't have to bring them back up.
This item was from 2012.
They were asking when people are more
once in a while.
Yeah, well, I did go a while and voted for it, but it's like it's going to come up again.
Why did you vote NAN in finance?
We can put it on the call and ask the other committees why they haven't done it.